everybody. It's Shop Talk Show time. We have two sponsors for you. One is Deploy, the URL deployhq.com. It's the easiest way to deploy code from your GitHub or Bitbucket repositories out to unlimited FTP, SSH, your S3 servers, whatever. Takes your repos, puts them live. Pretty darn great. Deploy HQ and Environments for Humans are promoting their Accessibility Summit. You and your team can learn how to level up with the web and mobile accessibility by taking 2 days with the industry's best accessibility trainers. You can do it all from your office or home because it's an online conference. Check it out at accessibilitysummit.com. That's A11Y summit.com. That's that thing where they like replace the number of letters that they remove in the word. You know how they do that?
A numeronym.
A11Y summit.com. Check it out. But for now, let's kick things off. Knee slapping, straw hat wearing websites.
Hey there, Shopomaniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. Today is it's just me and Chris, Dave and Chris.
We like to do Chris. These once in a while. It's the summer. We said we were going to do it. We just have a lot of questions that in this case, you know, we could have had a guest, but we just wanted to get through as many questions as we can and talk about stuff that me and Dave are, I guess, sometimes somewhat qualified to talk about or whatever.
Yeah. Just keeping it simple.
Yeah.
Stupid. What? Who's? No.
Kiss.
Anyway.
I'm always confused by that statement. What? I don't understand what kiss means, really.
Oh. Hey, Chris, we got rapid fire. We got heaps and heaps of questions. But before we get into questions,
yeah,
I wanted to, go back in time real quick, back to episode 175.
That's so long
rapid
ago.
Rapid fire 48, where we talked about the link pseudo selector, so like A:.
I think I was like crap talking it, really, just because nobody uses it and it's really hard to think of any kind of use case for it at all. It's like, why does this exist? I guess it kind of makes sense because it's like, I don't know, it's like there's pseudo alt states for all the other anchor element things, you know, like hover and active and focus, and those all add a little specificity, so maybe we should probably have one for when it's not really in any particular state at all, I guess, maybe, but like, it's so weird. What happened, Dave?
Well, so Raymond Schwartz commented, and then he reached out on Twitter like saying, hey, did you see this? And I was like, oh, you know what, we should bring it up, because it, he came up with a decent solution. So like his example, he's using BEM methodology, which is, you know, the world's
kind of like apply a class to everything. And it has like double dashes and double underscores and stuff. The idea is that you're kind of heavy with applying classes to stuff to kind of keep specificity flat and have a naming methodology so that, I don't know, you're not running, bumping into each other and stuff. You know, we're pretty big fans of naming methodologies around here.
Yep, it's the world's most complex naming solution. So, his example is a V card, like a let's say your address book card,
or not your traditional book, right? V card.
Not your traditional V card, which to be a V card also needs a certain set of classes. Anyway, let's keep going. But V card, and then like an item in that V card could be like an address, could be a name, could be a job title, could be a link like to a telephone number or that person's website. And
so you have one class name, and it could be applied to lots of different things, like Dave said, an address or whatever. And so if you wanted to style them differently, if you used this class name, which is V card __item, and like you wanted to do something a little bit different, if that happened to be applied to an anchor element, then you could use a CSS selector vcard item:link, right? Because then it would apply only when that happened to be an A element, but not if it was an address element or whatever. It's kind of a multi-useful class name then, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I thought that like that's clever. Yeah, like if you it and what you I think we were kind of saying before the show is that helps keep the specificity kind of as low as can be, because the second you drop like an A V card item, it, like you just said, I'm the champ of the world, so boom. So
Well, it's actually less than link because colon link adds 0100 to a class name, whereas a.vcardItem adds 001, right? Or whatever. Like one's a class, one's a tag, and those are different. So it's actually stronger than a.vcardItem is.
Oh, well, there you go.
Still, it's different, and sometimes different is useful, you know?
Yeah, I think this is a decent example. I think I was in the shower the other day, and I was just like, oh, I could maybe use it there. I think going back to our original answer, it's maybe not one of the most useful things just because it's sort of like you have to like stretch to find it. But this is exactly it, right?
You have to beg your mind for answers for link. It never like pops to mind as like, oh, I'll use that. That'll be useful. Anyway, thanks for the, like, it's kind of legit. Check out Raymond's comment. He even made a pen to demonstrate the concept there. So pretty cool. Thanks. And note that you can comment on all of our episodes. Yeah, Dave.
Yeah. And there's lots of good, even on this one, like Mandy, did not have a last name. Sorry, Mandy, you don't have a last name. But she's saying like, there's a PostCSS plugin for the very issue we mentioned at 40 minutes and 15 seconds. And then, Ed Hollingshurst, mentions Deploy.io, which, Deploy HQ is sponsoring the show. And I got to mention there. And anyway, Total Project.
Well, you mentioned both of them at the same time. It's saying that there's deployment tools available for stuff. The point is, there's an after show to Shop Talk sometimes where there's literally answers and discussion that happen after the show in the comments, which we're kind of working on revamping a little bit on the show. So look forward to that. This is a rapid fire show, so we could get way into that. Mr. Brad. Grabowski writes in. When using static, very close. When using static site generators like Jekyll, what are your solutions for processing contact or project quote forms? So Dave's site runs on Jekyll. We've even somewhat recently talked about potentially someday moving shopdocshow.com to Jekyll, because what's so awesome about Jekyll is that there's no like dependencies on databases and stuff. And it just kind of like feels a little better once you get the site all configured. If you don't need stuff that's super, super dynamic, you know, you don't need a login system. You don't need a built-in comment system. You know, you just don't, it doesn't need to do any server-side processing when a user arrives to the site. It's already done. It's just a flat HTML file. That's what Jekyll is great at. Thus, there's not even PHP probably running on the server that it's hosted on. There's no Ruby. There's no Python. There's nothing. So how do you, because that makes the server cheap and more secure and faster and all that stuff. So you'd probably on purpose not have those things available. But you kind of need them available if you're, for example, going to process a contact form, right? Like HTML can't send an email. So what would you do? Do you have a contact form on your site, Dave?
I don't, but I'm about to like get a lot of like contact through the Paravel site, which is just kind of, it's fine, but it's embarrassing because it's like, hey, David, I would like to hire you. And it's like, what? Don't talk to my company, and I'm not looking for a job. So, but I think I'm gonna need one. But
Paravel is a Jekyll site, and it has a contact form on it. So, how does it work?
Woofoo.
Is it really? It doesn't. Usually, I can sniff out a woofoo form 100 miles away because I used to work there or whatever. Yeah, it's just a highly customized one. Looks good.
Oh yeah, and we're actually going through and it's actually this weird PHP thing I made, but for managing your own forms is kind of less fun than you might think because hackers like to attack them and spam them and hijack them for their purposes.
So like even if you had the chops to process a form in PHP, which is, it's not like it's particularly difficult, but you know, so a form does a post or a get, right? That's the action attribute in HTML, and it will send the values in the form along with it, either in the URL or if when it's a post, it sends it as post data, and you need to process it, right? So you need to do all the security stuff, right? To make sure that no you're not like just like outputting on the page exactly what was input, because who knows, there could be weird JavaScript in there, or like, who knows, maybe it could execute a shell script somehow. You know, there's all kinds of security stuff that you have to deal with, not to mention it could just be spam, which is a bummer. So like, you just, you know, you can do it. I mean, like, people do it all the time. You can process your own forms if you want to. It's kind of more useful if you have something like Rails or something to help you, because then it can handle and help you with security and processing and all that stuff. Like Dave was saying, Wufoo is a pretty good choice, because, you know, you can even have sign up for a free account on Wufoo, go in there and drag and drop and make a little form and drop it in there. And then Wufoo deals with all of the processing of the form and the security and weeding out the spam. And it gets less spam anyway, because it's an iframe on the site, and you can custom style it however you want, like they have at Paravel. There's a custom style sheet applied to this, I can see, that makes it look just exactly perfectly like the rest of the Paravel site. It's a pretty good system. I mean, I used to work there, obviously, maybe, if you know my history at all. So I'm avoiding the sales pitch here. They're not sponsoring it or anything. But you could. That's a really good solution for a Jekyll site, is just to use something else to host it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, maximum bias, you know. Here, but it's a pretty good
solution. Could be a solution. Google Docs-y thing that you embed.
We're actually doing that on Day Trip. Like, we have a spot submitter thing, and because we aren't like if it's not like Foursquare, where if you submit your garage, we'll just put your garage on the website. So we like vet and editorialize the sites or the spots that get in there. Our spot form is all through a Google Doc, and you can like kind of custom style, and it's kind of bad and weird, but you know, you can do some things there. And we're also using that for our feedback submitters there. I think Google Docs are a good alternative too, you know, and unfortunately you don't get the email notification, or I have not figured out how to make that happen to where you get like a bing bong in your inbox that says, hey, somebody filled out your form. So, so that's why, again, I'd probably recommend Wufoo. It just kind of cuts down the spam. You can also write your own, you know, you can have like I have my static site generator spit out an HTAccess file. So you could have like your contact form spit out like, or your static site generator spit out a contact.php or whatever that does all your mail, you know, algorithms and processing. But again, like, there's some security,
and you should probably be saving it to a database, so it's not like just email and then gone forever, just in case your email is screwed up or something, or it gets spammed.
Yeah, let's pretend you forgot to put the correct email address in there, as Dave Rubin.
It should be blasting to a database so that you have that information still. It's not just kind of gone forever, and who knows what you'll want to do with it in the future. If you go to the Jekyll documentation, they recommend SimpleForm at getsimpleform.com and FormKeep. And both of them looks like they – and you can do this on Wufoo too. You can design the form and then download the HTML and drop the HTML onto the page, and it will still – submit, you know, that, you know, the action, what is it? There's the action attribute and then the type. What's the other attribute on a form? One of them is post or get, and the other one is the URL that it goes to. Method is post or get, and action is the URL that it goes to. Right. And so in both of these cases, they just give you the HTML and CSS, like you can also do with Wufoo if you want. And it posts to them. So that action URL is formkeep.com something something API key, whatever.
All right. Oh, that's good. Go ahead. Keep going.
That's it. So that's a way to do it. But you're not processing the form. They are. A third party is.
I was going to say, you could. All right. Hear me out. This is a free blog post title that will get you hundreds of hits. Making a contact form for your static site generator using Firebase and React. Done.
You know,
100 web hits.
Yeah, you'd get some hits for that. I would say just like, I would go general on CSS tricks, and I'd go like, building a contact form for your Jekyll site. And I'd probably like to list like three different ways you could do it or something. I might steal that. That's pretty good. But you can feel free to beat me to it, audience. But that's the kind of like long-term SEO good content I like to get. And if you want to write it for CSS tricks, even better. I'll pay you to write it.
Whoa, now we're talking free money to get email.
It's a business I'm in over here, Dave.
Pays for itself now.
Good luck, Brad. What do we got here from Patrick Kate, Dave?
I was wondering, either of you have any hands-on experience with any of the new HTML5 hybrid mobile app frameworks like Ionic, Angular Mobile, Framework 7, or React, React Native? Do they feel like they are legitimate alternatives to native apps at this point?
That's probably good for that question. He's just asking us for experience with mobile-ish frameworks. Before these existed, there was jQuery Mobile and stuff like that. The idea was it's a little bit like a mobile bootstrap in a sense, right? That it gives you a page that is designed to, at least Ionic is definitely that.
Yeah, it's basically like iOS or Android CSS. Like
it looks like that, or at least it's designed such that it has like appropriately sized tap targets and the pages like kind of slide over and behave in ways that you're kind of used to on mobile. A little bit different of maybe design patterns you could think of them as than on, I don't know, I guess more traditional websites. I don't have a lot of experience in it. I am a fan of Ionic. I know that a lot of people are. They're a kind of a Wisconsin homegrown thing, which is pretty cool. Even jQuery Mobile is. I don't know how actively developed that one is anymore, but it solved a lot of problems for a lot of people. I certainly wouldn't. I'd reach for a framework quicker in a situation like this where I'm building something where I intend it to be specifically mobile. I think my mind would reach for Ionic faster than if I'm just like building just some kind of website or something. Just because I don't know, I guess I have less experience in it. So Patrick is saying, are these alternatives to building native apps? But meanwhile, you listed React Native. Some of these frameworks, I'm not sure about Ionic or Angular Mobile or anything. The idea is if you build on them, they're web, but they also have a way to, I don't know, export, I guess. I don't know, compile to literally a native app. So, you know, an app that runs on Swift or whatever and gets you in the app store. So that would be appealing, wouldn't it? To kind of build a web app and have it be native. And this has been a thing forever. Remember, we had Rick Blaylock on a million years ago talking about how you can do this.
Like what app? Appetizer or
apps.
App
accelerator,
accelerator or something. Yeah. So I've used Ionic and I love it. I really do. Okay. It is cool. The discerning app user will know that it is not exactly native, but man, your users probably don't, if I'm totally honest with you. And the way native apps are going, they are, you know, it's only a 15% chance they will ever open your app twice.
Does it get all the way native?
Ionic? No. Ionic does not. So it's close, but the one cool thing that the advantage Ionic has right now is they will, it can compile to Android and iOS projects. So like you just say it, using PhoneGap or whatever, and then it'll restyle.
View.
Yeah. It'll restyle itself though. So like a tab bar becomes like the nav bar in a Android.
Oh, it restyles. Does that make sense? Itself. That's kind of neat. Yeah. So it's not native, but it looks native and helps you look native.
Yeah. Tries to like infer your meaning. And I think that's actually a really strong point, but you know, you may have to do some hacks to get around all that, but
ultimately you can build it such that it is an icon on the homepage or whatever. It just doesn't have all the same API. You wouldn't have like persistent login, for example.
It would just be the same as like a web view, but you know, you could also set the cookie or token would probably be the better way to do it. And you just store a token forever, you know, until they destroy that token. So,
Maybe then. So it's not like UI table view. It's a HTML page that looks like UI table view.
Yeah, it's Angular, so like you have to learn a little bit of Angular, and that's a little bit of a hurdle, if I'm completely honest, from nothing. But it's like it's you can also just write HTML and it works out great. So you're staying in your wheelhouse. Like listeners of the Shop Talk Show will probably say like, yes, HTML, CSS, and a little bit of JavaScript is my wheelhouse. You know, that's like, what's it called? That a baseline, you know, feeling. And like this will suit you to that. You take it a step further. If you like write React, like in your day-to-day job, React Native is actually pretty compelling too, because that now compiles out, like it builds
literally into Swift and, or whatever.
Yeah, it transpiles, if that makes sense. And so, and then,
well, that's way fancier because it's, I mean, it, not, you know, not that it's better necessarily, because you might actually prefer Ionic, because then you like you can rock some CSS and you just might prefer working in an all web environment. Whereas I feel like you might feel a little more helpless, like the transpiling's way fancy and it gets you all this native action, but you might feel a little bit more helpless at the end because you're like, I don't know what to do with.
Yeah, like I don't know how to fix that. Yeah. It's kind of different, too different for what I'm used to. But and I looked at both of these, like I was just like, oh, you know, I'm building out a little prototype. What do I need to do? And React not going to Android is kind of a deal breaker right now. It's right now, I know they're working on it, but it's not built yet. So for me, that was sort of a deal breaker. And Ionic does a pretty good job of it. You can just kind of get to experiencing it. And so,
neither of us are really advocating for just trying to do this from scratch then necessarily. That's kind of funny, you know. Scratch kind of guy a lot of times, but maybe not actually, with something like this.
There's actually a really good post by one of the Ionic developers, and you know, they have solved hundreds of problems about memory management. How do you have an infinite scrolling list on you know, that is scroll performant at 60 FPS? Like, how do you do that stuff? And without, you know, how do you get like good touch, you know, reaction? You know, they have the thing where you click and you drill into a menu, you know, like you click and it slides over and then you can like slide it back slowly. Like they built that in there. And otherwise it's DaveRupert.com trying to code that up himself. And I am not as good as it, you know. David DeSandro is maybe really good at it, and you know, because he does all these Flickity and all these touch libraries. But Dave Rupert isn't good enough to like be within 10 milliseconds of your thumb, you know. So
fair.
That's right. Like, so they've solved a lot of problems that you have not even considered building your little mobile app, you know. So. But if you don't want to even, if you want to deploy to all of these and not even use the like iOS style conventions, like tab bars and header bars and back buttons and stuff, like then write your own. Sure, it'll probably be better. But like if you want to adhere to their conventions, then I would.
It's tough. I mean, you could imagine, for example, like a conference website that goes either way. One of them is like super appy and has like the bottom has like schedule and buy tickets and whatever. Like, I don't know, like some of the main navigation. It looks really a lot like a very standard grade web app, or one that's just real, real, real different. Just like a bespoke website that has a totally more website looking. Anyway, we've dwelled upon that one probably long enough. Let's see how far are we into this? 23 minutes. Well,
I was also just going to say, for day trip with app I'm building by myself, like I'm probably going to do the Ionic route just to get it out the door. And then if it's good and people like, you know, it's making millions of dollars, has you know, Mark Andreessen's got me on the horn, like I want to give you money, then I'm probably going to be like, well, I'll go native from that point. But until then, I'm just going to stick to my wheelhouse. So,
and it'll be interesting to see how you customize it, and when you're done with it, we'll take a look and see. Like, you know, does it look like it's like,
yeah, how does it look? Feel?
How does it feel? Does it look like Day Trip or does it look like Ionic?
Yeah, that's good. That's a good point. Like, you know, and if I'm 80% there, that's probably not enough for me and for Paravel. But if it's like we're like 98% there, that's like great, because we did that for $0 for free 99, you know. So anyway,
so that's what you know, Dave has to work on Day Trip, and he's got to somehow make changes to it on his local machine and then get it out to live servers. how does Dave do that? He has some kind of deployment process, probably has some kind of repository that he works with. Well, deployhq.com can help with that. The app's name is actually just deploy, and it deploys from your GitHub or Bitbucket repos, which is probably like what 98% of you all use probably. It supports Git, Mercurial, and Subversion, but it's kind of great. What's so interesting about all this is that like GitHub, you know, like or all those other three or whatever, too, often just deal with the repo, and they deal with like issue tracking in a wiki and, you know, pull requests, and they do all this stuff, and then they stop short of deployment. Like GitHub just doesn't help you with deployment. They have little tools, little like post commit hooks and stuff that can kind of help you with deployment, but they don't really get into the deployment game. And it's probably a business choice by them. Like, that's risky. You're now like really could be hurting businesses and stuff if you screw up or whatever. It just seems like, I'm not sure why they don't, but you're often left to deployment on your own. So it's like, do you write something yourself? Wow, learn Capistrano, sure, fine, but that is complicated stuff. I can personally, Chris Coyer, can use GitHub just fine, but I want help with the deployment process. Deploy HQ is right up my alley. I can use this to set up my deployment because I know my FTP credentials or my SFTP credentials. I go to deployhq.com. I have an account there. I set up what, you know, I attach it to my Git repos, and I attach it to give it my FTP or SSH credentials or whatever, and tell it how to behave. Push this to this S3 area. Push this to my staging server. Push this to my live server and behave how I want you to behave. My master branch always just gets deployed immediately, for example, or this branch, or, you know, or it goes to staging first, and then if I put this in the commit hook or in the commit message, then I want it to go out to the live site or whatever. You configure it how you want it to work. That's what Deploy HQ does for you, and does a fantastic job of doing it. Oh, so cool, right? It doesn't have to, and you can, you know, they're not even in the market of hosting your repo. Your repo is elsewhere. It just helps you with the deploy stuff. You you want to try it out? 30 days for free. Use coupon code SHOPTALK. So then even after your free 30-day trial, you get 50% off the first month that you pay for it, and it's only like $9 a month. So it's kind of like nothing anyway. You need deployment. You need deployment, and it can do it for you. Cool. Thanks to Deploy. Sorry if I went off on that. I'm just a big fan of Deploy HQ.
People who solve that problem.
Yes, it's a really good thing to pay for, I think.
I got jammed up by that last week, so it's cool. Thank you for sponsoring. So, all right, let's go into the next question. Chris House talks to us. No, Chris writes,
your show.
WordPress plugins make my life easier, but I really dislike the extra code being injected into my page. Seeing strange style sheet references and inline style tags in my output HTML is like fingernails on a chalkboard to me. Where should I draw the line between utilizing helpful plugins and keeping control of my code?
So I think this is fascinating. Probably,
everyone's seen this, right? You install.
Yeah, you throw in contact form 7 and it loads in contact form 7.css, contact form 7.js. And you're like, oh, great. It's two new HTTP requests, right?
Yep. Inline style block where it's like colon this form, you know, P margin bottom 1.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And there's maybe 3 of them because you have other plugins doing the same thing because they're attaching to your WP head hook and they're just throwing stuff up there. And it's kind of not really their fault. Like, I mean, it's they're doing it, but this is how, you know, if you write a WordPress plugin, you expect it to be popular, it better as heck work. And this is how you get it to work. And it would be, you know, if they were like, well, okay, but people hate, you know, extra HTTP requests. Fine. Well, inline styles everything? No. We'll figure out how to concatenate our script with the rest of your script somehow? No, that's dangerous and weird and overreaching. They just...
And if you had like a date picker, you can't rely on the site's styles, you know.
Yeah, not at all.
To make that work.
You need some HTML and some CSS and some JavaScript. it's just going to have to happen for plugins to do their thing. But the deal is you don't have to just be like, well, I got to make a decision here. You know, if I want to use this contact form, I need to load two extra HTTP requests. There are ways to handle this. I have an article on CSS Tricks about it. The plugin that I'm using right now that I think is really, really, really well done is called MinQ, M-I-N-Q-U-E-U-E. And it just says, like, here's the IDs essentially of any enqueued script or style, and I'm going to stop it from blasting on the page all by itself, but I'm going to grab it and concatenate it with all the rest of those and then put it on the page. That's it. That's as simple as it does. And then it kind of caches that or whatever. So it's like, I have to update mine because right now I use a plugin called Featured Comments, which allows me to kind of click on a comment and give it like a special styling if it's a good one. And I have a separate one that works for BB Press as well. And I use a polls plugin called WP Polls. I use an anti-spam one that has to inject a little JavaScript to do its thing. I use the related post thing in Jetpack. I think I turned that one off, but I used to. There's a good six or seven things here that all inject separate scripts. Terrible for performance. No good, just like you noticed, Chris. So all I have to do is go in here, put the little IDs in there, boop, 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 and it compresses them all for me. But it gives me the control to do that. Now I'm using it WooCommerce a little bit, so I have some scripts that I haven't yet done this to, but it's just a couple of clicks away to do it. It's really easy, and it gives you a level of control that I like. So there's, you know, I think there's other like performance plugins that kind of do this for you, but you don't have to. But you know, like, do it for you with being like, I'm just gonna guess. I'm just gonna grab everything that I think I see and smash it together. That kind of like freaks me out a little bit. This is kind of like, no, I want these ones combined. And maybe I even want a couple other ones on different pages kind of smushed together separately or whatever. It gives me a level of control that I really like, and it works for scripts as well as styles. So
yeah, that's, I like the idea. Like, yeah, when it's just spitting stuff on your page, you're like, I can't control this. This is awful. But that, like, the idea that there's a,
yeah, and that's how this is how WordPress was supposed to work. Responsible plugins aren't just spitting a link tag on it. They're using a WordPress hook called like WP enqueue script or WP enqueue style, and that's what gives it the ID that I'm talking about. So it's saying, you know, when you can spit this out, and that gives theme offers like, well, I output scripts in the footer because I'm trying to be responsible, and it gives a hook to undo it if you want to. And so, you know, that's another way you could do this, is totally take matters into your own hand and even do the, you know, use like some grunt task or something to combine all your scripts together. So you need a hook to unqueue it. That's a step. That's like too much control, because then I have to tell Grunt like what the URL paths of all my plugins are, where to go grab these scripts and combine them and stuff. Like, that's cool, but that's like more maintenance. This is just like, I know what I want you to do, just kind of do it to these particular plugins. Anyway, long story, Chris House, but don't not use a plugin because you think it's injecting stuff that you don't have control over. Check out the plugin, MinQ.
Open source. So if like they are not doing it right, like file an issue and just say, hey, could I get either an optional button for the CSS or this, you know, or could I get a,
right,
you know, like, can I control this? Cause I'm smart. You know, they might respond to that. So
it's so simple that I feel like it's one of those plugins that's just going to work forever too. I have a couple, like it's not that complicated, you know? So it just grabs some, dequeues some files and squishes some other ones together and throws it into a cache. It's like not a big deal. Okay. Anit Kumar writes in, how do I select or deselect a div in JavaScript on a mouse click event? Or on the first click, select the div, and on another click, deselect the div?
Is
it like select the text in there, or give it some like generic sense of UI, like this is now selected? I don't know, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, focus and blur are kind of that's what it's called, right?
Div doesn't have a focus state. It's not a type of element that has that. A text area does, an input does, but a div doesn't, you know?
Right, and you could put, now you're getting in trouble, but you could put tab index
and then it
equals
would, yeah.
zero, and
or
it
content
is
editable,
a focusable div.
And then it would be focused.
Or content editable. And then when you click another div, it'll just, that'll actually work automatically, you know?
Right. It will just be in a selected state, but it won't actually select the text inside. So a neat, if you're asking about how do you select the text inside, it would have to be content editable. And probably, I'm pretty darn sure actually. And then also whatever, execute whatever JavaScript you do to select stuff. I know in jQuery, it's just like, if you're on a text area, you just do like dot focus and it like, or I think it's stuff. There's some really simple API for just like select the stuff inside.
I mean, jQuery has like dot select, I think is the actual method.
Yeah.
And Git there, but I don't think it's a cross browser win. But maybe I'm thinking you can get the selecting, like you can, you know, get range at, and you can get things in it, but like the next step is you're going to want to copy to the clipboard or something, and that's hard to do. So, but yeah, I could probably work up a little code pen for you to make this happen. But yeah, if you're trying to, yeah, there's a selection API, here on your, on MDN. So, and you have to use this thing called get range at, and, so you have to select everything. Yeah.
Ugh. Yeah.
That doesn't sound good.
Trying to figure out too, but it seems like it's, you can get this done. And then the question is like, is it text selection that you're even talking about? Or are you talking about some other kind of generic, like, you know, I don't know, you click it because you just, your app, you know, you're trying to simulate some kind of interaction where you're like, pick the time of for haircuts that is the best for you. And you have a bunch of divs that have a bunch of like hour ranges in them or something, you know, and you didn't want to use a drop down. You wanted to use your own custom UI. So when you click on that div, yeah, it just kind of becomes selected, but it's not really a form element or anything. It's just like you want to like apply a blue glow around it or something. Then you're in the territory of just like on click, apply a class called is selected or whatever, and then, you know, and then know that you're going to need to you know, store that data somehow, because of presumably ultimately you're going to be submitting it as form data. I don't know. It's not very clear in your short questions.
Yeah, I wish we had more to go off of. I think I was wrong about the selection API, but I did just find this thing called document.activeElement, which seems like it could help you too if you did that. But careful out there. Tab index can be pretty rough. So, yeah.
Orlando Baez writes in, he's a front-end developer. Most of his job comes from outside agencies outsourcing design work that needs to be coded, right? So here's the Photoshop file, boss. It's always full site mockups that need to be pixel perfect. Some nicer people even give me the desktop version and expect me to make it responsive. I know everyone has said over and over again, it's not the way to do things anymore. He likes Brad Frost posts about this subject. I actually preach about the cons of doing it with talking with others in the industry, but I feel like such a hypocrite since it's 90% of my work. Is this workflow something that's just taken a long time to change, or am I just working with some agencies that are staying behind? It seems like a kind of a communication issue to me in a sense. Do you, I don't know, I'm sure, you know, Paravel's such a unique agency, but maybe in the early days or something, was it common to get a have someone just toss you a PSD and desktop and have that be the kind of canonical design document for everything?
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing, you know, we were very into pixel perfection. You know, I would get a design and I would, you know, export it as a JPEG, and then that would make that the background of my body,
sure.
You know?
Oh, and I would, ooh, really?
Like,
and then you'd try to line stuff up to it just right?
Literally align
everything. That's clever. I never did it that way, but I could see why you might.
Or you open it up in the you know, PSD right next to you, or the, you know, whatever, preview or photos or whatever right next to you. And then you make that half the size, and then you make the browser, you lay that over the browser and it should line up perfectly, you know, texts and everything and anti-aliasing, blah, blah, blah. It was exhausting, you know? And then I've also been in the position where we contract with a agency or a company with their own design shop, and they send you red lines. And I don't know if you've ever gotten these, Chris, but these are documents where every pixel is redlined. Like you, it's like, this is 10 pixels from this thing. This is 1.1 pixels from this thing. I think red lines are awful. I think they are a sign that an agency doesn't understand things.
That seems a little extreme, but starting with a desktop mock-up doesn't sound so awful to me. And maybe that's egregious or whatever, but I am playing with a new redesign of CSS Tricks. I pop open Sketch, and I started with the desktop thing because it just feels fun to explore what that's going to look at. It doesn't mean that it's going to stay that way forever. Even when working with Sparkbox for the, and this is all documented on a site that we're talking about the process, they started with some Photoshop mockups of what CodePen looks like as a desktop style. Then it moves on from there, and we do some back and forth and talk about how some things work. But it doesn't, I even feel like, it's your job too, in a sense, Orlando, to make some decisions about how a layout might shift around or whatever. I wouldn't say like, ugh, I can't believe I have to make this responsive. These designers should be tossing me mobile designs as well as screen designs, because we've already, I think that another thing the industry has said over and over is that it's unrealistic to provide full-fledged fidelity Photoshop or whatever design documents at every breakpoint or every little micro breakpoint. That seems like a bad use of time too. So maybe it kind of makes sense to design one of them and then start conversations about what happens at different breakpoints. I think you do more work in this regard than I do though.
Yeah. I mean, I think it turns into a conversational thing, you know, like what they designed, like you can target that, but like, you know, you might have to, it might make more sense to use a percentage value than a pixel value in some, you know, horizontal padding or something. And like, they didn't account for that in their mockup. So you have to adjust the design to be that. But from a designer perspective, it's like, let's say white space, right? Like they put, you know, like 60 pixels of white space, you know, like, you could, and you're just like, I don't know, that looks like 40 to me, you know. To them, you know, that's a 33% decrease in white space. And that's like a significant look and feel thing, you know. So when you're fielding like feedback, like that's wrong or this needs to be pixel perfect, like I think it's probably like they want a certain vibe nailed, you know, that there's an aesthetic that they need to have. And if they're kind of unable or unaware, that's a problem. But if they're unable to communicate, that's a separate problem. And what I've noticed with Paravel stuff is I'll like get a desktop comp or maybe like a mobile-y sketch, you know, and I'll just have to infer all the stuff in between. So I make a lot of design decisions, you know, which, you know, but then it's like just being like, hey, I just did this. I'm not attached to it.
But just doing something is a pretty good start, don't you think?
Yeah, like let's just work together and like figure out the middle, because it's like the worst thing I think you could do if you're just being a subcontract developer, and maybe I'm being too hardline, like don't get emotionally involved with your client. just try to reach the goal. Like you're going to make design decisions and as a front end developer, but like while you're in browser, but you know, that then it's, I think you just say, hey, these are some like decisions I made or some problem areas, like let's work it out together. Maybe you can abstract some of that into a code pen. So you're just talking about one component or area or padding or something. And they could, you know, if they're a little tech savvy, they can kind of, you know, move numbers up and down. That always helps. So
yeah. Love it.
So anyway, good luck. It's not easy, especially like when
communication again, you know, is like one of these answers for everything that you got to talk it out with them. If you feel like it's outdated, yeah, maybe they'd prefer to be designing some extra stuff for you or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, another one of these things about websites is they ought to be accessible.
Hey.
So you should learn all about it because it's so gosh darn important. And if you don't know why it's important, maybe that's an extra reason to attend a conference all about it. The URL you should check out is a11ysummit.com. This is an Environments for Humans online conference, which they have that thing down to a science. They are excellent at bringing the online conference experience to you, which is, you know, it's cool for lots of reasons. The ones we talk about all the time, like the fact that, you know, you don't have to fly anywhere. You don't have to buy expensive meals out. You don't have to buy a hotel room. You don't have to take time away from your family and job and stuff. You can just pop open a tab and hang out at this conference and be engaged in it as you want to, and be dropping questions into chat and stuff. They're recorded so you can watch them over and over when they're done if there's stuff that you missed. It's really a very nice way to attend a conference, and it generally are more affordable anyway. So this particular one, you know, you get to spend some time with accessibility experts, find the inspiration and practical knowledge you need to make your website truly universal. All new talks on modern accessibility tips and techniques from industry leaders will leave you with a fresh perspective and the inspiration to build accessibility into all of your projects from the ground up. Very, 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 very cool. A11ysummit.com will get you to the place where you can buy tickets and stuff. That's coming up September 8th and 9th. And it's kind of an all-day thing, like 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Central Time, which I guess is like 10 to 5 Eastern or 7 to 2 Western. Why isn't it Western time? We have to say Pacific. It's so confusing.
Ugh.
Cool. Let's do a few more if we can get
this conference looks great. 2 days.
Yeah, it's like, a 2 day.
Man, lots. Anyway, okay. I might have to buy a ticket. So, all right. Wonderful. Let's get going. Brian Reich writes in, how do you guys feel about an ad agency creating and maintaining their own CMS when there are already so many high quality solutions available?
That's probably fine. He goes on to say that, you know, he works at an agency where they have some kind of WordPress hate or whatever, which, you know how I feel about it, but I don't really care. If you don't want to use WordPress, fine. There are approximately 7 million other CMSs out there. And so Brian is like, "Oh my gosh, so they just wrote their own. They threw it together. He's cobbled together an ASP.net a long time ago. They never work on it, but it's the thing they all use. I can kind of see, you know, it's like not invented here syndrome or whatever. I can see why people originally do it, but it seems like CMS is one of these things that's, you know, I wouldn't go so far as to call it a solved problem. I'm sure Karen McGrain would agree with that like CMSs are often out of the box not quite ready for every content need. In fact, they usually aren't. They require some degree of customization. Maybe that's where this comes from as well, is that if you make it in-house, maybe they think it's more customizable that way for the needs of what they do, but I have a feeling that's probably not the case. And existing CMS solutions are often quite customizable on themselves. I just feel like it's such an easy thing to do a bad job of, to screw up, to not do securely. It's, you know, it's harder to hire for. There's just a million reasons why you should use a pre-existing CMS, and it's kind of stupid not to. What do you think?
Speaking as somebody who has worked at an agency where we did supply our own custom CMS, I want to get out of that business. I mean, the maintainability is a big thing, you know. Security things happen, you know, and now you have to like go through dozens of sites, you know, hundreds of sites to fix it, you know. And what I feel like it is, it's sort of a Trojan horse for, like, keep paying us, you know, which it keeps the agency afloat, and that's great. But it's also this, oh, you need an update. Well, it costs $12 million to get that feature, you know.
Now you're charging your clients more because you have to, because it's so bespoke.
Yeah, I mean, and it's hard. And so that's, I mean, I think eventually we made the decision to go all, you know, open source, or we work a lot with Vector Media, who's really good at craft and expression engine. So, and oftentimes if there's any kind of sniff about a kind of custom implementation of something, it's like, we'll hand it off to them because we know that they do that and they're a really good shop at that, you know? And they are just, you know, they're still like using Expression Engine. It's not this own like version of it, but it's like, they know they are really good at extending it and making it custom. So that might be a thing for your company to do, is look at something like Craft would be a great example. You know, how do we get, how can we do what we're doing here in this, you know, weird, I think he goes on in the question to mention Win Merge and all this weird stuff. How can we create what we have created here and instead do that in an open source context? Cause what is it's the old Linus Torvalds saying, or maybe that's, but with enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. So,
right. That's the classic argument here, is that you're just going to get a better product by using one, and they're free. So pretty cool. Right. And there's way more community behind it. And it just seems like, gosh, everything points to using something pre-existing. On the other side of the spectrum, it's like, what if the thing is, we ain't even got time for our CMS. I kind of understand that, meaning not only are we not going to use it in-house, we're not even going to deal with it at all. We're going to kind of outsource the CMS aspect to it. I have a friend who works at a university where they just bought one and they spent all kinds of money for it, but the idea is they don't have to host it or upgrade it or deal with customizing it themselves. They have a, you know, because they spent a bunch of money, this company kind of does that for them and builds them just what they need, which kind of makes sense sometimes, because I can see an organization that has people that work in departments and stuff that can certainly realize the need for a website and are more than happy to jump into some kind of thing and put events in there or blog posts or just kind of deal with maintaining the website, but don't have a large tech department, don't have, you know, it just doesn't make sense for them to hire 10 people or whatever it needs to have a web team, because that represents an incredible amount of money, which, you know, I know working at CodePen, if we wanted to hire 10 people, That's a lot. It's millions of dollars over years to hire those people. It just is, with the high salaries of web people and all the overhead and benefits and all that type of stuff. Not every organization has millions of dollars to throw at something, but they could throw maybe half of that at a CMS product that's going to build them a kind of great website or whatever. It kind of makes sense. So, anyway, that was quite the rant. Can we fit in one more?
Yep, we got an audio question from Austin Prey. It's loading. It is a self-hosted cloud app link. Here we go.
What is the best way to test your website in different network environments? I'll tell you what I'm doing right now. I found an app called Slowy, which seems to simulate crappy internet connections well enough. And then I combine my GIMP connection with the Web Inspector, and I can React and optimize from there. But what is everybody else doing?
All right, so great question, Austin. I just live at my house. Hey, no,
that's good.
I just signed up for Time Warner.
I just try to use Comcast in Philadelphia.
Waka 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 waka.
Sorry, I just made your same joke only worse. It's like Twitter's number one hobby.
Yeah. Cox Cable, but in Nebraska. Anyway, okay. So this might have been an older question, but I mean, I am frequently in Web Inspector now, and they just moved it into the network panel. But they have there's throttling
yeah, in Chrome, the network you panel. You can rock throttling right in there. Like, what does my website feel like to go slow? Well, let me click a checkbox and find out.
And what's weird is like DSL, the difference between like DSL, which is pretty common network connection, and like, you know, regular or spotty 3G or whatever, good 3G, is crazy. It's just wild, you know. Even just Wi-Fi is like throttled at 30 megabytes a second and stuff, you know. I think this is a big deal. I mean, I'm in Austin, Texas, been threatening for a few years here to get Google Fiber, and like it's happening. They leave door things on my door, but I'm gonna have no concept of how fast a website is unless I use throttling, you know, in the real world.
It might make sense for you to do it more universally at some point too, like have a network level one instead of just a Chrome one. Maybe, although I don't know if you'd like on purpose make your like tweeties or like tweetbot slow. That would be kind of obnoxious, but you know, I guess that's the point kind of. Look at it, even similarly, it's offline. That's cool. 0K a second.
And I mean, that's a big thing too, is like, you know, are you doing things, you know, like, is it, are you, I don't know, like, have you considered what your site is on a slower connection? I think is a big thing. The other day, actually, I was like, working on Daytrip, the app I work on my spare times there. And, I was getting like, I was like a 1 second DOM content loaded, you know, and I was just like, gosh, that seems really slow. You know, it was like 1 second or 1.5 or something. And I was just like, this is a very simple site. What's taking so long? And I had it throttled, and then I like turned off throttling, and it was like 300 seconds or milliseconds or something. And I was just like, hot dang, this is awesome. Like, it was cool. Like I was working in a throttled environment and I didn't realize it. And so, but I was kind of seeing things happen. So that was neat, I guess. Kind of frustrating, but neat.
What does Jake Archibald call the one that's not just throttling, but it's like up, down, it's like Li-Fi or something?
Oh, Li-Fi. Is that it? Yeah.
That's hard to simulate, like, you know?
Yeah, because you don't, like, you know, when you see like two bars on your phone.
It's trying to hold on to it, but you've already gone into a tunnel or whatever. You know, I know that's the cliche one, but you're just kind of losing it somehow. And it's like, it's still trying to get data, but it doesn't really have it. So it's not really, yeah.
Yep.
Ugh, that one's hard to simulate.
Chris Rupel is a Drupalista, or Isto, if I use Spanish proverbs or whatever pronouns. He works at Four Kitchens, and they have this thing called Web Perf Wednesday, where it kind of encourages people to put their throttlers on for like a morning or a day, just to kind of experience the web. So that's something if you're interested in that. So follow Chris; he's a good guy. So.
We had Dave Hunt write in. He said, you know, he's been working in the web for a while now. I was wondering about his title. That's something that has always been kind of interesting. There's some CSS tricks posts on it. And Laura Shank we had on to kind of talk about this kind of thing. But he says, you know, I have a lot of experience with HTML and CSS and JavaScript and jQuery and designing sites and wireframing and PHP and Rails and Python, but like not a lot of backend experience. But he does some maintain their SQL databases. And it's like one of these things where you pick and choose little things that you know about. And then what's your title? Yeah, it's like, it kind of doesn't matter, but sometimes it does, because sometimes you need to like get a new job and explain to them what you did. Hopefully you can just explain it, but sometimes like whether you're a junior or senior or whatever kind of matters to them. So it's tough. I don't know what to tell you, Dave Hunt, exactly. But I can tell you about a particular job. So this show is brought to you in part by the Shop Talk job board, which is at shoptalkshow.com/jobs, which we had a glowing endorsement of recently. Someone posted a job there and said that they got 20 leads and 8 interviews and 3 hires. which is pretty darn good. So people are hiring off this job board, and they're having success in posting jobs there, which I just couldn't imagine it being that good. There's one particular job I want to mention to you because it looks like kind of an awesome one. It's at an agency called Clock. It's a digital agency, and it's in the UK. It's in Kings Langley, United Kingdom, which is such an awesome name. Everything over there sounds Hertfordshire. It's the best. I love the names of everything in the UK. But it's over there. And they, you know, it's a big fancy agency. And I feel like one of the tests for like whether you want to work somewhere or not is if their website is kind of awesome, and their website is kind of awesome. So check out clock.co.uk, but also we'll have a link to the actual job in there. They're hiring a front-end developer. You know, they work for big prestigious clients over there in the UK that also have cool names, of course. But, you know, they're looking for the type of people that listens to this show, essentially. They're looking for, of course, you need HTML, CSS, JavaScript, jQuery, understanding UX. It'd be nice if you knew some pre-processing and Git and, you know, are aware that SEO is kind of a thing. If you know a little Node, that's cool. If you are into naming conventions, they could use that. It's a permanent full-time job. In Kings Langley in Hertfordshire at Clock. It's like, looks just like a job. Like, are you a front ender? Are you like us? Are you the type of person who listens to Shop Talk Show? You'd be great to take the front end developer position at Clock. So check that out at the Shop Talk job board. And we'll put a link to this exact job in the show notes for this show.
There you go. So yeah, that's a good set up there. And all right, well, hey, thanks everyone for listening to this episode of the Shop Talk Show. This has been another rapid fire. Thank you for listening. Please be sure to follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. Vote us up in your podcatcher of choice. That's how people find out about the show. And if you've done that, and if you've been leaving reviews and everything in iTunes, we really appreciate it. That, like, that it goes such a long way, and that's how people find us, hear about us, you know, if you just share it. And so thanks a lot. And people are finding Shop Talk. Like every day, I feel like somebody's like, I've listened to Shop Talk. So thank you if you're new to listening. There's 180, I guess, ish episodes in the backlog. But it's, you know, you don't have to listen to all of them because, whoa, boy, some of it's out of date. All right. So we really appreciate you joining the show. And yeah. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to share there?
Yeah. ShopTalkShow.com.